Duchess. You should have seen the look on Emmett's face when he realized who was standing in the door. From his expression, you would have thought we'd popped out of thin air. Back in the early 40s, there was an escape artist who went by the name of Cousin Tikis. Some of the wisecrackers on the circuit liked to call him the half-wit Houdini from Hackensack, but that wasn't totally fair. While the front half of his act was a little shaky, the finale was a gem. Right before your eyes, he'd get bound up in chains, locked in a trunk, and sunk to the bottom of a big glass tank. A good-looking blonde would wheel out a giant clock as the MC reminded the audience that the average human being can only hold his breath for 2 minutes, that deprived of oxygen, most grow dizzy after 4, and unconscious after 6. Two officers of the Pinkerton Detective Agency were present to ensure that the padlock on the trunk was secure, and a priest from the Greek Orthodox Church, complete with a long black cassock and long white beard, was on hand should it prove necessary to administer the last rites. Down into the water the trunk would go, and the blonde would start the clock. At 2 minutes, the members of the audience would whistle and jeer. At 5 minutes, they would ooh and ah. But at 8 minutes, the Pinkertons would exchange worried glances. At 10, the priest would cross himself and recite an indecipherable prayer. At the 12th minute, as the blonde burst into tears, two stagehands would rush from behind the curtains to help the Pinkertons hoist the trunk from the tank. It would be dropped to the stage with a thump as water gushed across the footlights and into the orchestra pit. When one of the Pinkertons fumbled with his keys, the other would brush him aside, draw his pistol, and shoot off the lock. He would rip open the lid and tip over the trunk, only to discover it was empty. At which point, the Orthodox priest would pluck off his beard, revealing that he was none other than Cousin Tikis, his hair still wet, as every single member of the audience looked on in holy amazement. That's how Emmett Watson looked when he realized who was standing in the door. Of all the people in the world, he just couldn't believe it was us. Duchess? In the flesh. And woolly, too. He still looked dumbfounded. But how? I laughed. That's the question, right? I put a hand to the side of my mouth and lowered my voice. We hitched a ride with the warden. While he was signing you out, we slipped into the trunk of his car. You can't be serious. I know. It's not what you'd call first-class travel. What with it being 100 degrees in there, and Wooly complaining every 10 minutes about having to go to the bathroom, and when we crossed into Nebraska, I thought I was going to get a concussion from the divots in the road. Someone should write a letter to the governor. Hey, Emmett, said Wooly, like he'd just joined the party. You've got to love that about Wooly. He's always running about 5 minutes late, showing up on the wrong platform with the wrong luggage just as the conversation is pulling out of the station. Some might find the trait a little exasperating, but I'd take a guy who runs 5 minutes late over a guy who runs 5 minutes early any day of the week. Out of the corner of my eye, I'd been watching as the kid who'd been sitting on a hay bale began edging his way in our direction. When I pointed, he froze like a squirrel on the grass. Billy, right? Your brother says you're sharp as a tack. Is that true? The kid smiled and edged a little closer until he was standing at Emmett's side. He looked up at his brother. Are these your friends, Emmett? Of course we're his friends. They're from Salina, Emmett explained. I was about to elaborate when I noticed the car. I'd been so focused on the charms of the reunion that I hadn't seen it hiding behind the heavy equipment. Is that the Studebaker, Emmett? What do they call that, baby blue? Objectively speaking, it looked a little like a car that your dentist's wife would drive to bingo. But I gave it a whistle anyway. Then I turned to Billy. Some of the boys in Salina would pin a picture of their girl back home on the bottom of the upper bunk so they could stare at it before lights out. Some of them had a photo of Elizabeth Taylor or Marilyn Monroe. But your brother? He pinned up an advertisement torn from an old magazine with a full-color picture of his car. I'll be honest with you, Billy, we gave your brother a lot of grief about that, getting all moon-eyed over an automobile. But now that I see her up close... I shook my head in a show of appreciation. Hey, I said, turning to Emmett, can we take her for a spin? Emmett didn't answer because he was looking at Wooly, who was looking at a spider web without a spider. How are you doing, Wooly? He asked. Turning, Wooly thought about it for a moment.
I'm all right, Emmett.
When was the last time you had something to eat?
Oh, I don't know. I guess it was before we got in the warden's car. Isn't that right, Duchess?
Emmett turned to his brother. Billy, you remember what Sally said about supper? She said to cook it at 350 degrees for 45 minutes. Why don't you take Wooly back to the house, put the dish in the oven, and set the table? I need to show Duchess something, but we'll be right behind you.
Okay, Emmett.
As we were watching Billy and Wooly walk back toward the house, I wondered what Emmett wanted to show me. But when he turned in my direction, he didn't look himself. As a matter of fact, he seemed out of sorts. I guess some people are like that when it comes to surprises. Me, I love surprises. I love it when life pulls a rabbit out of a hat. Like when the blue plate special is turkey and stuffing in the middle of May. But some people just don't like being caught off guard, even by good news.
Duchess, what are you doing here?
Now it was me who looked surprised. What are we doing here? Why, we've come to see you, Emmett, and the farm. You know how it is. You hear enough stories from a buddy about his life back home, and eventually you want to see it for yourself. To make my point, I gestured toward the tractor and the hay bale and the great American prairie that was waiting right outside the door, trying its best to convince us that the world was flat after all. Emmett followed my gaze, then turned back.
I'll tell you what, he said. Let's go have something to eat. I'll give you and Wooly a quick tour. We'll get a good night's sleep. Then in the morning, I'll drive you back to Selena.
I gave a wave of my hand. You don't need to drive us back to Selena, Emmett. You just got home yourself. Besides, I don't think we're going back. At least not yet.
Emmett closed his eyes for a moment. How many months do you have left on your sentences?
5 or 6? You're both practically out.
That's true, I agreed. That's perfectly true.
But when Warden Williams took over for Ackerley, he fired that nurse from New Orleans, the one who used to help Wooly get his medicine. Now he's down to his last few bottles, and you know how bluesy he gets without his medicine.
It's not his medicine.
I shook my head in agreement. One man's toxin is another man's tonic, right?
Duchess, I shouldn't have to spell this out for you, of all people, but the longer you two are AWOL, and the farther you get from Selena, the worse the consequences are going to be. And you both turned 18 this winter, so if they catch you across state lines, they may not send you back to Selena. They may send you to Topeka.
Let's face it, most people need a ladder and a telescope to make sense of 2 plus 2. That's why it's usually more trouble than it's worth to explain yourself. But not Emmett Watson. He's the type of guy who can see the whole picture right from the word go. The grander scheme and all the little details. I put up both of my hands in surrender. I'm with you 100%, Emmett. In fact, I tried to tell Wooly the very same thing in the very same words, but he wouldn't listen. He was dead set on jumping the fence. He had a whole plan. He was going to split on a Saturday night, hightail it into town, and steal a car. He even pilfered a knife when he was on kitchen duty. Not a paring knife, Emmett. I'm talking about a butcher knife. Not that Wooly would ever hurt a soul. You and I know that. But the cops don't know it. They see a fidgety stranger with a drifty look in his eye and a butcher knife in his hand, and they'll put him down like a dog. So I told him if he put the knife back where he'd found it, I'd help him get out of Selena safe and sound. He put back the knife, we slipped into the trunk, presto changeo, here we are. And all of this was true, except the part about the knife. That's what you'd call an embellishment, a harmless little exaggeration in the service of emphasis.
sort of like the giant clock in Cousin Tikis's act, or the shooting of the padlock by the Pinkerton. Those little elements that on the surface seem unnecessary, but that somehow bring the whole performance home. Look, Emmett, you know me. I could have done my stretch and then done Woolies. 5 months or 5 years, what's the difference? But given Woolies' state of mind, I don't think he could have done 5 more days. Emmett looked off in the direction that Woolie had walked. We both knew that his problem was one of plenty. Raised in one of those doorman buildings on the Upper East Side, Woolie had a house in the country, a driver in the car, and a cook in the kitchen. His grandfather was friends with Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, and his father was a hero in the Second World War. But there's something about all that good fortune that can become too much. There's a tender sort of soul who, in the face of such abundance, feels a sense of looming trepidation, like the whole pile of houses and cars and Roosevelts is going to come tumbling down on top of him. The very thought of it starts to spoil his appetite and unsettle his nerves. It becomes hard for him to concentrate, which affects his reading, writing, and arithmetic. Having been asked to leave one boarding school, he gets sent to another, then maybe another. Eventually, a guy like that is going to need something to hold the world at bay. And who can blame him? I'd be the first to tell you that rich people don't deserve 2 minutes of your sympathy. But a big-hearted guy like Woolie? That's a different story altogether. I could see from Emmett's expression that he was going through a similar sort of calculus, thinking about Woolie's sensitive nature and wondering if we should send him back to Selena or help him safely on his way. As a quandary, it was pretty hard to parse. But then I guess that's why they call it a quandary. It's been a long day, I said, putting a hand on Emmett's shoulder. What say we go back to the house and break bread? Once we've had something to eat, we'll all be in a better frame of mind to weigh the whys and wherefores. Country cooking. You hear a lot about it back east. It's one of those things that people revere even when they've never had any first-hand experience with it, like justice and Jesus. But unlike most things that people admire from afar, country cooking deserves the admiration. It's twice as tasty as anything you'd find at Delmonico's, and without all the folderol. Maybe it's because they're using the recipes their great-great-grandmas perfected on the wagon trail. Or maybe it's all those hours they've spent in the company of pigs and potatoes. Whatever the reason, I didn't push back my plate until after the third helping. That was some meal. I turned to the kid, whose head wasn't too far over the tabletop. What's the name of that pretty brunette, Billy? The one in the flowery dress and work boots, whom we have to thank for this delectable dish?
Sally Ransom, he said. It's a chicken casserole made from one of her own chickens.
One of her own chickens? Hey, Emmett. What's that folksy saying? The one about the fastest way to a young man's heart?
She's a neighbor, said Emmett.
Maybe so, I conceded. But I've had a lifetime supply of neighbors, and I've never had one who brought me a casserole. How about you, Woolie?
Woolie was making a spiral in his gravy with the tines of his fork. What's that?
Have you ever had a neighbor bring you a casserole? I asked a little louder.
He thought about it for a second. I've never had a casserole.
I smiled and raised my eyebrows at the kid. He smiled and raised his eyebrows back. Casserole or no casserole, Woolly suddenly looked up like he'd had a timely thought.
Hey, Duchess, did you get a chance to ask Emmett about the escapade?
The escapade? Asked Billy, poking his head a little higher over the table.
That's the other reason we came here, Billy. We're about to set off on a little escapade, and we were hoping your brother would come along.
An escapade, said Emmett.
We've been calling it that for lack of a better word, I said. But it's a good deed, really, a sort of mitzvah. In fact, it's the fulfillment of a dying man's wish. As I began to explain, I looked from Emmett to Billy and back again, since the two seemed equally intrigued. When Woolie's grandfather died, he left some money for Woolie in what they call a trust fund. Isn't that right, Woolie? Woolie nodded.
Now, a trust fund is a special investment account that's set up for the benefit of a minor, with a trustee who makes all the decisions until the minor comes of age, at which point the minor can do with the money as he sees fit. But when Wooly turned 18, thanks to a little bit of fancy jurisprudence, the trustee, who happens to be Wooly's brother-in-law, had Wooly declared temperamentally unfit. Wasn't that the term, Wooly?
Temperamentally unfit, Wooly confirmed with an apologetic smile.
And in so doing, his brother-in-law extended his authority over the trust until such time as Wooly should improve his temperament, or in perpetuity, whichever comes first. I shook my head. And they call that a trust fund?
That sounds like Wooly's business, Duchess. What does it have to do with you?
With us, Emmett. What does it have to do with us? I pulled my chair a little closer to the table. Wooly and his family have a house in upstate New York.
A camp, said Wooly.
A camp, I amended, where the family gathers from time to time. Well, during the Depression, when the banks began failing, Wooly's great-grandfather decided he could never entirely trust the American banking system again. So just in case, he put $150,000 in cash in a wall safe at the camp. But what's particularly interesting here, even fateful, you might say, is that the value of Wooly's trust today is almost exactly $150,000. I paused to let that sink in. Then I looked at Emmett directly. And because Wooly's a man who's big of heart and modest of needs, he has proposed that if you and I accompany him to the Adirondacks to help him claim what is rightfully his, he will divvy up the proceeds in three equal parts.
$150,000 divided by three is $50,000, said Billy.
Exactly, I said.
All for one and one for all, said Wooly.
As I leaned back in my chair, Emmett stared at me for a moment. Then he turned to Wooly.
This was your idea? It was my idea, Wooly acknowledged.
And you're not going back to Selena?
Wooly put his hands in his lap and shook his head. No, Emmett. I'm not going back to Selena.
Emmett gave Wooly a searching look, as if he were trying to formulate one more question. But Wooly, who was naturally disinclined to the answering of questions and who'd had plenty of practice in avoiding them, began clearing the plates. In a state of hesitation, Emmett drew a hand across his mouth. I leaned across the table. The one hitch is that the camp always gets opened up for the last weekend in June, which doesn't give us a lot of time. I've got to make a quick stop in New York to see my old man, but then we're heading straight for the Adirondacks. We should have you back in Morgan by Friday. A little road-weary, maybe, but on the sunny side of 50 grand. Think about that for a second, Emmett. I mean, what could you do with 50 grand? What would you do with 50 grand? There is nothing so enigmatic as the human will. Or so the head-shrinkers would have you believe. According to them, the motivations of a man are a castle without a key. They form a multi-layered labyrinth from which individual actions often emerge without a readily discernible rhyme or reason. But it's really not so complicated. If you want to understand a man's motivations, all you have to do is ask him, "What would you do with $50,000?" When you ask most people this question, they need a few minutes to think about it, to sort through the possibilities and consider their options. And that tells you everything you need to know about them. But when you pose the question to a man of substance, a man who merits your consideration, he will answer in a heartbeat and with specifics, because he's already thought about what he would do with 50 grand. He's thought about it while he's been digging ditches, or pushing paper, or slinging hash. He's thought about it while listening to his wife, or tucking in the kids, or staring at the ceiling in the middle of the night. In a way, he's been thinking about it all his life. When I put the question to Emmett, he didn't respond. But that wasn't because he didn't have an answer. I could see from the expression on his face that he knew exactly what he'd do with $50,000, nickel for nickel and dime for dime. As we sat there silently, Billy looked from me to his brother and back again. But Emmett, he looked straight across the table like he and I were suddenly the only people in the room.
Maybe this was Wooly's idea, and maybe it wasn't, Duchess. Either way, I don't want any part of it. Not the stop in the city, not the trip to the Adirondacks, not the $50,000. Tomorrow I need to take care of a few things in town. But on Monday morning, first thing, Billy and I are going to drive you and Wooly to the Greyhound station in Omaha. From there, you can catch a bus to Manhattan or the Adirondacks or anywhere you like. Then Billy and I will get back in the Studebaker and go on about our business.
Emmett was serious as he delivered this little speech. In fact, I've never seen a guy so serious. He didn't raise his voice, and he didn't take his eyes off me once, not even to glance at Billy, who was listening to every word with a look of wide-eyed wonder. And that's when it hit me, the blunder I'd made. I had laid out all the specifics right in front of the kid. Like I said before, Emmett Watson understands the whole picture better than most. He understands that a man can be patient, but only up to a point. That it's occasionally necessary for him to toss a monkey wrench in the workings of the world in order to get his God-given due. But Billy, at the age of 8, he probably hadn't set foot out of the state of Nebraska. So you couldn't expect him to understand all the intricacies of modern life, all the subtleties of what was and wasn't fair. In fact, you wouldn't want him to understand it. And as the kid's older brother, as his guardian and sole protector, it was Emmett's job to spare Billy from such vicissitudes for as long as he possibly could. I leaned back in my chair and gave the nod of common understanding. "Say no more, Emmett. I read you loud and clear." After supper, Emmett announced that he was walking over to the Ransoms to see if his neighbor would come jump his car. As the house was a mile away, I offered to keep him company, but he thought it best that Wooly and I stay out of sight. So I remained at the kitchen table, chatting with Billy while Wooly did the dishes. Given what I've already told you about Wooly, you'd probably think he wasn't cut out for doing dishes, that his eyes would glaze over and his mind would wander, and he'd generally go about the business in a slipshod fashion. But Wooly, he washed those dishes like his life depended on it. With his head bent at a 45-degree angle and the tip of his tongue poking between his teeth, he circled the sponge over the surface of the plates with a tireless intention, removing some spots that had been there for years and others that weren't there at all. It was a wonder to observe, but like I said, I love surprises. When I turned my attention back to Billy, he was unwrapping a little package of tinfoil that he'd taken from his knapsack. From inside the tinfoil, he carefully withdrew 4 cookies and put them on the table, 1 cookie in front of each chair. "Well, well, well," I said. "What do we have here?"
"Chocolate chip cookies," said Billy. "Sally made them."
While we chewed in silence, I noticed that Billy was staring rather shyly at the top of the table, as if he had something he wanted to ask.
"What's on your mind, Billy?"
"All for one and one for all," he said a little tentatively. "That's from the 3 Musketeers, isn't it?"
"Exactly, mon ami." Having successfully identified the source of the quotation, you might have imagined the kid would be pleased as punch. But he looked despondent, positively despondent. And that's despite the fact that the mere mention of the 3 Musketeers usually puts a smile on a young boy's face. So Billy's disappointment rather mystified me. That is, until I was about to take another bite, and I recalled the all-for-one and one-for-all arrangement of the cookies on the table. I put my cookie down.
"Have you seen the 3 Musketeers, Billy?"
"No," he admitted, with a hint of the same despondency. "But I have read it."
"Then you should know better than most just how misleading a title can be." Billy looked up from the table.
"Why is that, Duchess?"
"Because in point of fact, the 3 Musketeers is a story about 4 musketeers. Yes, it opens with the delightful camaraderie of Orthos and Pathos and Artemis."
"Athos, Porthos, and Aramis?"
"Exactly. But the central business of the tale is the means by which the young adventurer—"
"D'Artagnan."
by which D'Artagnan joins the ranks of the swashbuckling threesome, and by saving the honor of the queen, no less.
That's true, said Billy, sitting up in his chair. In point of fact, it is a story about four musketeers.
In honor of a job well done, I popped the rest of my cookie in my mouth and brushed the crumbs from my fingers. But Billy was staring at me with a new intensity.
I sense that something else is on your mind, young William.
He leaned as far forward as the table would allow and spoke a little under his breath.
Do you want to hear what I would do with $50,000?
I leaned forward and spoke under my breath, too. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
I would build a house in San Francisco, California. It would be a white house, just like this one, with a little porch and a kitchen and a front room. And upstairs, there'd be three bedrooms, only instead of a barn for the tractor, there'd be a garage for Emmett's car.
I love it, Billy. But why San Francisco?
Because that's where our mother is.
I sat back in my chair. You don't say. Back at Salina, whenever Emmett mentioned his mother, which wasn't very often, to be sure, he invariably used the past tense. But he didn't use it in a manner suggesting that his mother had gone to California. He used it in a manner suggesting that she had gone to the great beyond.
We're leaving right after we take you and Wooly to the bus station, added Billy.
Just like that, you're going to pack up the house and move to California.
No, we're not going to pack up the house, Duchess. We're going to take what little we can fit in a kit bag.
Why would you do that?
Because Emmett and Professor Abernathy agree that's the best way to make a fresh start. We're going to drive to San Francisco on the Lincoln Highway, and once we get there, we'll find our mother and build our house.
I didn't have the heart to tell the kid that if his mother didn't want to live in a little white house in Nebraska, she wasn't going to want to live in a little white house in California. But setting the vagaries of motherhood aside, I figured the kid's dream was about $40,000 under budget.
I love your plan, Billy. It's got the sort of specificity that a heartfelt scheme deserves. But are you sure you're dreaming big enough? I mean, with $50,000, you could go a hell of a lot further. You could have a pool and a butler. You could have a four-car garage.
Billy shook his head with a serious look on his face. No, he said. I don't think we will need a pool and a butler, Duchess.
I was about to gently suggest that the kid shouldn't jump to conclusions, that pools and butlers weren't so easy to come by, and those who came by them were generally loath to give them up, when suddenly Wooly was standing at the table with a plate in one hand and a sponge in the other.
No one needs a pool or a butler, Billy.
You never know what's going to catch Wooly's attention. It could be a bird that settles on a branch, or the shape of a footprint in the snow, or something someone said on the previous afternoon. But whatever gets Wooly thinking, it's always worth the wait. So as he took the seat next to Billy, I quickly went to the sink, turned off the water, and returned to my chair, all ears.
No one needs a four-car garage, Wooly continued. But I think what you will need is a few more bedrooms.
Why's that, Wooly?
So that friends and family can come visit for the holidays.
Billy nodded in acknowledgement of Wooly's good sense, so Wooly continued making suggestions, warming to his subject as he went along.
You should have a porch with an overhanging roof so that you can sit under it on rainy afternoons, or lie on top of it on warm summer nights. And downstairs there should be a study, and a great room with a fireplace big enough so that everyone can gather around it when it snows. And you should have a secret hiding place under the staircase, and a special spot in the corner for the Christmas tree.
There was no stopping Wooly now. Asking for paper and pencil, he swung his chair around next to Billy's and began drawing a floor plan in perfect detail. And this wasn't some back-of-the-napkin sort of sketch. As it turned out, Wooly drew floor plans like he washed dishes. The rooms were rendered to scale, with walls that were parallel and corners at perfect right angles. It gave you a zing just to see it. Setting aside the merits of a covered porch versus a four-car garage, you had to give Wooly credit on the dreaming front. The place he imagined on Billy's behalf was three times the size of the one the kid had imagined on his own, and it must have struck a chord. because when Wooly was done with the picture, Billy asked him to add an arrow pointing north and a big red star to mark the spot where the Christmas tree should go. And when Wooly had done that, the kid carefully folded the floor plan and stowed it away in his pack. Wooly looked satisfied too, although when Billy had cinched the straps nice and tight and returned to his chair, Wooly gave him his sad sort of smile.
"I wish I didn't know where my mother is," he said.
"Why's that, Wooly?"
"So that I could go and look for her just like you."
Once the dishes were clean and Billy had taken Wooly upstairs to show him where he could shower, I did some poking around. It was no secret that Emmett's old man had gone bust. But all you had to take was one look around the place to know it wasn't from drinking. When the man of the house is a drunk, you can tell. You can tell from the look of the furniture and the look of the front yard. You can tell from the look on the faces of the kids. But even if Emmett's old man was a teetotaler, I figured there had to be a drink of something somewhere, like maybe a bottle of apple brandy or peppermint schnapps tucked away for special occasions. In this part of the country, there usually was. I started with the kitchen cabinets. In the first, I found the plates and bowls. In the second, the glasses and mugs. In the third, I found the usual assortment of foodstuffs, but no sign of a bottle, not even hiding behind the 10-year-old jar of molasses. There wasn't any hooch in the hutch, either. But in the lower compartment was a jumble of fine china covered in a thin layer of dust. Not just dinner plates, you understand. There were soup bowls, salad plates, dessert plates, and teetering towers of coffee cups. I counted 20 settings in all, in a house without a dining room table. I seem to remember Emmett telling me his parents had been raised in Boston. Well, if they were raised in Boston, it must have been on the top of Beacon Hill. This was the sort of stuff that is given to a Brahmin bride with every expectation it will be handed down from one generation to the next. But the whole collection could barely fit in the cupboard, so it certainly wasn't going to fit in a kit bag. Which sort of made you wonder. In the front room, the only place to stow a bottle was in the big old desk in the corner. I sat in the chair and rolled up the top. The writing surface had the normal accessories, scissors, a letter opener, a pad and pencil, but the drawers were cluttered with all sorts of things that had no business being there, like an old alarm clock, a half a deck of cards, and a scattering of nickels and dimes. After scraping up the loose change, waste not, want not, I opened the bottom drawer with my fingers crossed, knowing it to be a classic stowing spot. But there was no room for a bottle in there, because the drawer was filled to the brim with mail. It didn't take more than a glance to know what this mess was all about. Unpaid bills. Bills from the power company and the phone company, and whoever else had been foolish enough to extend Mr. Watson credit. At the very bottom would be the original notices, then the reminders, while here at the top, the cancellations and threats of legal action. Some of those envelopes hadn't even been opened. I couldn't help but smile. There was something sort of sweet in how Mr. Watson kept this assortment in the bottom drawer, not a foot away from the trash can. It had taken him just as much effort to stuff the bills inside his desk as it would have to consign them to oblivion. Maybe he just couldn't bring himself to admit that he was never going to pay them. My old man certainly wouldn't have gone to the trouble. As far as he was concerned, an unpaid bill couldn't find its way into the garbage fast enough. In fact, he was so allergic to the very paper on which bills were printed, he would go to some lengths to ensure that they never caught up with him in the first place. That's why the incomparable Harrison Hewitt, who was something of a stickler when it came to the English language, was occasionally known to misspell his own address. But waging a war with the U.S. Postal Service is no small affair. They have entire fleets of trucks at their disposal, and an army of foot soldiers whose sole purpose in life is to make sure that an envelope with your name on it finds its way into your mitts, which is why the Hewitts were occasionally known to arrive by the lobby and depart by the fire escape, usually at 5 in the morning. "Ah," my father would say, pausing between the 4th and 3rd floors and gesturing toward the east,
Rosy-fingered Dawn, count yourself lucky to be of its acquaintance, my boy. There are kings who never laid eyes upon it.
Outside, I heard the wheels of Mr. Ransom's pickup turning into the Watson's Drive. The headlights briefly swept the room from right to left as the truck passed the house and headed toward the barn. I closed the bottom drawer of the desk so that the whole pile of notices could remain safe and sound until the final accounting. Upstairs, I stuck my head into Billy's room, where Wooly was already stretched out on the bed. He was humming softly and staring at the airplanes hanging from the ceiling. He was probably thinking about his father in the cockpit of his fighter plane at 10,000 feet. That's where Wooly's father would always be for Wooly, somewhere between the flight deck of his carrier and the bottom of the South China Sea. I found Billy in his father's room, sitting Indian style on the bed covers with his knapsack at his side and a big red book in his lap.
Hey there, gunslinger. What are you reading?
Professor Abacus Abernathy's Compendium of Heroes, Adventurers, and Other Intrepid Travelers.
I whistled.
Sounds impressive. Is it any good?
Oh, I've read it 24 times.
Then good may not be big enough a word.
Entering the room, I took a little stroll from corner to corner as the kid turned the page. On top of the bureau were two framed photographs. The first was of a standing husband and seated wife in turn-of-the-century garb. The Watsons of Beacon Hill, no doubt. The other was of Emmett and Billy, from just a few years back. They were sitting on the same porch that Emmett and his neighbor had sat on earlier that day. There was no picture of Billy and Emmett's mother.
"Hey, Billy," I said, putting the photograph of the brothers back on the bureau. "Can I ask you a question?"
"Okay, Duchess."
"When exactly did your mother go to California?"
"On the 5th of July, 1946.
"That's pretty exactly. So she just up and left, huh? Never to be heard from again?"
"No," said Billy, turning another page. "She was heard from again. She sent us 9 postcards. That's how we know that she's in San Francisco."
For the first time since I'd entered the room, he looked up from his book.
"Can I ask you a question, Duchess?"
"Fair's fair, Billy."
"How come they call you that?"
"Because I was born in Dutchess County."
"Where's Dutchess County?"
"About 50 miles north of New York."
Billy sat up straight.
"You mean the city of New York?"
"None other."
"Have you ever been to the city of New York?"
"I've been to hundreds of cities, Billy, but I've been to the city of New York more than I've been to anywhere else."
"That's where Professor Abernathy is. Here, look."
Turning to one of the first pages, he offered up his book.
"Small print gives me a headache, Billy. Why don't you do the honors?"
Looking down, he began reading with the help of a fingertip.
"Dearest reader, I write to you today from my humble office on the 55th floor of the Empire State Building at the junction of 34th Street and 5th Avenue on the Isle of Manhattan in the city of New York at the northeastern edge of our great nation, the United States of America."
Billy looked up with a certain level of expectation. I responded with a look of inquiry.
"Have you ever met Professor Abernathy?" he asked.
I smiled.
"I've met a lot of people in our great nation, and many of them from the Isle of Manhattan, but to the best of my knowledge, I have never had the pleasure of meeting your professor."
"Oh," said Billy.
He was quiet for a moment, then his little brow furrowed.
"Something else?" I asked.
"Why have you been to hundreds of cities, Duchess?"
"My father was a thespian. Although we were generally based in New York, we spent a good part of the year traveling from town to town. We'd be in Buffalo one week and Pittsburgh the next, then Cleveland or Kansas City. I've even spent some time in Nebraska, believe it or not. When I was about your age, I lived for a stretch on the outskirts of a little city called Lewis."
"I know Lewis," said Billy. "It's on the Lincoln Highway, halfway between here and Omaha."
"No kidding."
Billy set his book aside and reached for his knapsack.
"I have a map. Would you like to see?"
"I'll take your word for it."
Billy let go of the knapsack. Then his brow furrowed again.
"When you were moving from town to town, how did you go to school?"
Not all worth knowing can be found between the covers of compendiums, my boy. Let's simply say that my academy was the thoroughfare, my primer experience, and my instructor, the fickle finger of fate. Billy seemed to consider this for a moment, apparently unsure of whether he should be willing to accept the principle as an article of faith. Then, after nodding twice to himself, he looked up with a touch of embarrassment.
"Can I ask you something else, Duchess?"
"Shoot."
"What is a thespian?"
I laughed. "A thespian is a man of the stage, Billy. An actor." Extending a hand, I looked into the distance and intoned, "She should have died hereafter. There would have been a time for such a word. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death." It was a pretty good delivery, if I do say so myself. Sure, the pose was a little hackneyed, but I put a world of weariness into the tomorrows, and I hit that old dusty death with an ominous flair. Billy gave me his patented wide-eyed look. "William Shakespeare from the Scottish play," I said, "Act 5, Scene 5.
"Was your father a Shakespearean actor?"
"Very Shakespearean."
"Was he famous?"
"Oh, he was known by name in every saloon from Petaluma to Poughkeepsie." Billy looked impressed, but then his brow furrowed once again.
"I have learned a little about William Shakespeare," he said. "Professor Abernathy calls him the greatest adventurer to have never set sail on the seas, but he never mentions the Scottish play."
"Not surprisingly. You see, the Scottish play is how theater folk refer to Macbeth. Some centuries ago, it was determined that the play was cursed, and that to speak of it by name can only bring misfortune upon the heads of those who dare perform it."
"What sorts of misfortune?"
"The worst sorts. At the very first production of the play back in the 1600s, the young actor cast as Lady Macbeth died right before going on stage. About 100 years ago, the two greatest Shakespearean actors in the world were an American named Forrest and a Brit named Macready. Naturally, the American audience was partial to the talents of Mr. Forrest. So when Macready was cast in the role of Macbeth at the Astor Place Opera House on the Isle of Manhattan, a riot broke out in which 10,000 clashed and many were killed." Needless to say, Billy was enthralled.
"But why is it cursed?"
"Why is it cursed? Have you never heard the tale of Macbeth? The black-hearted Thane of Glamis?
What? No?
Well then, my boy, make some room, and I shall bring you into the fraternity." Professor Abernathy's compendium was set aside, and as Billy got under the covers, I switched off the light, just as my father would have when he was about to tell a dark and grisly tale. Naturally enough, I began on the fen with the three witches bubbling, toil and troubling. I told the kid how, spurred by the ambitions of the missus, Macbeth honored the visit of his king with a dagger through the heart, and how this cold-blooded act of murder begot another, which in turn begot a third. I told him how Macbeth became tormented by ghostly visions, and his wife began sleepwalking the halls of Cawdor while wiping the specter of blood from her hands. Oh, I stuck the courage to the sticking place, all right. And once the trees of Birnam Wood had climbed the hill of Dunsinane, and Macduff, that man of no woman born, had left the regicide slain upon the fields, I tucked Billy in with a wish of pleasant dreams. And as I retreated down the hall, I took a bow with a gentle flourish, when I noted that young Billy had gotten out of bed to switch the light back on. Sitting on the edge of Emmett's bed, what struck me immediately about his room was all that wasn't in it. While there was a chip in the plaster where a nail had once been lodged, there were no pictures hanging, no posters or pennants. There was no radio or record player. And while there was a curtain rod above the window, there were no curtains. If there had been a cross on the wall, it could well have been the cell of a monk. I suppose he could have cleared it out right before going to Selena. Putting his childish ways behind him, and what have you, by dumping all his comic books and baseball cards in the trash. Maybe. But something told me this was the room of someone who had been preparing to walk out of his house with nothing but a kit bag for a long, long time. The beams from Mr. Ransom's headlights swept across the wall again, this time from left to right as the truck passed the house on its way to the road. After the screen door slammed, I heard Emmett turn off the lights in the kitchen, then the lights in the front room. When he climbed the stairs, I was waiting in the hall. "Up and running?" I asked.
"Thankfully."
He looked genuinely relieved, but a little worn out, too. "I feel terrible putting you out of your room. Why don't you take your bed and I'll sleep downstairs on the couch? It may be a little short, but it's bound to be more comfortable than the mattresses at Selena." In saying this, I didn't expect Emmett to take me up on the offer. He wasn't the type, but I could tell he appreciated the gesture. He gave me a smile and even put a hand on my shoulder.
"That's all right, Duchess. You stay put and I'll join Billy. I think we could all use a good night's sleep."
Emmett continued down the hall a few steps, then stopped and turned back.
"You and Wooly should switch out of those clothes. He can find something in my father's closet. They were about the same size. I've already packed things for Billy and me, so you can take what you want from mine. There's also a pair of old book bags in there that you two can use."
"Thanks, Emmett." As he continued down the hall, I went back into his room. From behind the closed door, I could hear him washing up, then going to join his brother. Lying down on his bed, I stared at the ceiling. Over my head were no model airplanes. All I had was a crack in the plaster that turned a lazy curve around the ceiling lamp. But at the end of a long day, maybe a crack in the plaster is all you need to trigger fanciful thoughts. Because the way that little imperfection curved around the fixture was suddenly very reminiscent of how the Platte River bends around Omaha. Oh, Omaha, I remember thee well. It was in August of 1944, just 6 months after my 8th birthday. That summer, my father was part of a traveling review claiming to raise money for the war effort. Though the show was billed as The Greats of Vaudeville, it might just as well have been called The Cavalcade of Has-Beens. It opened with a junky juggler who'd get the shakes in the second half of his act, followed by an 80-year-old comedian who could never remember which jokes he'd already told. My father's bit was to perform a medley of Shakespeare's greatest monologues, or, as he put it, a lifetime supply of wisdom in 22 minutes. Wearing the beard of a Bolshevik and a dagger in his belt, he would lift his gaze slowly from the footlights in search of that realm of sublime ideas located somewhere in the upper right-hand corner of the balcony. "And thence wouldst commence, but soft, what light through yonder window breaks?" And, "Once more unto the breach, dear friends," and, "O reason not the need." From Romeo to Henry to Lear, a tailor-made progression from the moonstruck youth to the nascent hero to the doddering old fool. As I recall, that tour began at the Majestic Theater in glamorous Trenton, New Jersey. From there, we headed west, hitting all the bright lights of the interior from Pittsburgh to Peoria. The last stop was a one-week residence at the Odeon in Omaha. Tucked somewhere between the railway station and the red light district, it was a grand old deco spot that hadn't had the good sense to turn itself into a movie theater when it still had the chance. Most of the time, while we were on the road, we stayed with the other performers in the hotels that were suited to our kind, the ones frequented by fugitives and Bible salesmen. But whenever we reached the final stop on a tour, that stop from which there would be no forwarding address, my father would check us into the fanciest hotel in town. Sporting the walking stick of Winston Churchill and the voice of John Barrymore, he would saunter up to the front desk and ask to be shown to his room. Discovering that the hotel was fully booked and had no record of his reservation, he he would express the outrage appropriate to a man of his station.
"What's that? No reservation?" Why, it was none other than Lionel Pendergast, the general manager of the Waldorf Astoria and a close personal friend, who, having assured me that there was no other place in Omaha to spend the night, called your offices in order to book my room.
When the management would eventually admit that the presidential suite was available, Pops would concede that, though he was a man of simple needs, the presidential suite would do very nicely, thank you. Once ensconced, this man of simple needs would take full advantage of the hotel's amenities. Every stitch of our clothing would be sent to the laundry. Manicurists and masseuses would be summoned to our rooms. Bellboys would be sent out for flowers. And in the lobby bar every night at 6, drinks would be ordered all round. It was on a Sunday in August, the morning after his last performance, that my father proposed an excursion. Having been hired for a run at the Palladium in Denver, he suggested we celebrate by having a picnic on the bank of a meandering river. As we carried our luggage down the hotel's back stairs, my father wondered whether perhaps we should augment our festivities by bringing along a representative of the gentler sex. Say, Miss Maples, that delightful young lady whom Mephisto, the cross-eyed magician, had been sawing in half every night in the second act. And who should we find standing in the alley with her suitcase in hand but the buxom blonde we'd just been discussing?
"Tally-ho," said my father.
Ah, what a delightful day that turned out to be. With me in the rumble seat and Miss Maples up front, we drove to a large municipal park on the edge of the Platte River, where the grass was lush, the trees were tall, and the sunshine glistened on the surface of the water. The night before, my father had ordered a picnic of fried chicken and cold corn on the cob. He had even stolen a tablecloth right out from under our breakfast plates. Try that one, Mephisto. Miss Maples, who couldn't have been more than 25, seemed to delight in my old man's company. She laughed at all his jokes and warmly expressed her gratitude whenever he refilled her glass with wine. She even blushed at some of the compliments he had stolen from the bard. She had brought along a portable record player, and I was put in charge of picking the records and cueing the needle as the two of them danced uncertainly on the grass. It has been observed that that which comforts the stomach dullens the wits, and surely no truer words have ever been said. For after we had tossed the wine bottles into the river, packed the phonograph into the trunk, and put the car in gear, when my father mentioned that we needed to make a quick stop in a nearby town, I thought nothing of it. And when we pulled up to an old stone building on top of a hill, and he asked me to wait with a young nun in one room while he spoke to an older nun in another, I still thought nothing of that. In fact, it was only when I happened to glance through the window and spied my father speeding down the driveway with Miss Maple's head on his shoulder that I realized I'd been had.